Hello and welcome to episode 63 of React Native Radio. I'm your host, Nader Dabit. Today on our panel, we have Kevin Old.
Hello.
Peter Pykarczyk.
Hey, everybody.
And our special guest today is Nicole Chung. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So basically, the main topic today, and why we brought Nicole on, we're going to be kind of talking about building progressive web apps using React and building progressive web apps in general. I know a lot of our listeners build React Native apps, but most of them have transitioned to React Native from web development in some form or fashion. So, and I know a lot of us are still actually building web apps. So this is kind of an overlapping topic, and I think it'll be a great thing to talk about. So I kind of saw Nicole when I was at ReactConf. I didn't actually end up seeing your talk because I ended up leaving early and I had a few different things going on during the conference, but I did check it out on YouTube, and it's called How to React in the Slow Lane. And it's a really excellent talk. So we're going to be, you know, kind of discussing some of the stuff that you kind of talked about there in that talk. But I guess before we jump into the topic, do you mind kind of just giving us an overview of how you got into programming and kind of what you're doing right now in your career?
Yeah, so I guess I probably am like not like the model path on like how to become a programmer. I went to film school and I came out and I was sort of making independent film and working in as a production assistant and working in music videos. And that wasn't really going so great. So I started working at a bank and I didn't like that either. So I just quit. And that's kind of how I became a programmer. I just wanted to try something different and I thought I would like learn to program, and I didn't really have a clear cut path for that. I think I got lucky and I had a lot of people teach me some really cool things. And, you know, there is a demand for front-end developers. So it's kind of something I just fell into. And that's it. Like, it just kind of happened over a series of years, like working in different places and like learning things from different people. And we have a pretty strong community in Toronto. So like, if you're eager and you're like willing to learn, there's like lots of people that are like out there to help you.
So is JavaScript kind of like your first language that you've been using like as a professional? And like how long did it kind of take to pick up and then be employed, you know, as a developer? Because this is kind of a similar path that I took. I didn't even really become a developer until I was like in my late 20s. And I kind of was also self-taught and I had a similar experience to you, like tried a few things and they didn't work out. And then, you know, I got into being a developer and it really, you know, I really enjoy it and I like doing it. But yeah, so like how long did it take you to kind of go from trying it out and like trying to learn and then actually becoming employed?
I think I was working in a bank for quite a long time, like doing sort of web content updating. So it was semi-related, but not really. Like we were mostly updating content on a website. And then when I quit, my friend was working at a documentary film production company and they needed another web developer. So I actually got a job like 3 weeks later. So I found my first few set of jobs, I'd usually be like one or two of like maybe, yeah, like one or two web developers in an environment where no one else was a web developer. So I would get work done. Like I'd be doing like WordPress sites, like writing jQuery and stuff like that. But, and like trying to teach myself on the side, but it really wasn't like a great environment in terms of learning. And then after that, I had a bit of a bigger network. So I just started freelancing and working with different developers and then kind of being in the freelance world. And I think it wasn't until I got into an agency that I felt like I really started to learn and grow. Because, you know, when you're surrounded by people who are like really strong developers, they kind of like take the time to let you know that you should learn about things that you didn't even really knew existed before. So like I had maybe like a rough idea about design patterns or MVC or like algorithms, but you know, that's something that like, you know, it's like, it's a lot more useful or helpful when you're in an environment where someone's taking the time to explain that to you.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I've had a similar experience. Definitely the company that I'm kind of with now, I have some really awesome people that I work with that are just super smart and they do take the time to kind of sit down with me and it's helped me big time. So what company are you with now?
I'm with a product studio in Toronto. They're called TWG. We build software for enterprises and startups. That's mainly what we do.
Okay, cool. So you guys, I guess, kind of bring in projects from companies that are looking to build a product. Do you take them to launch, or do you kind of build an MVP, or do you do both of those and then also maintain them, or kind of what happens when the project is finished?
We do a mix of stuff, like depending on the client. Like sometimes we just build out prototypes. I know some of the clients, like we've had for like 6 years, it's been like a longer relationship. So it could be a variety of things.
So I guess we'll go ahead and jump into the topic now. What about progressive web apps interests you, and are you working with those within your company?
It's something we're really interested in, and we're trying to learn as a team, and we're starting to educate our clients on. But I don't think we've started to like actively make progressive web apps ourselves.
Can you talk about how you kind of got into React Conf and became like a speaker and all that stuff? That's a pretty cool experience, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty fantastic. Like I subscribed to the React newsletter, and I remember at the end of December, they sent out a call for proposals, and they said like beginners are welcome, and you could do a 5-minute talk or a 20-minute talk depending on what you got in for. So I just sort of applied and I got in, which was really great. And I think also one thing about the experience, like as a first time speaker, they really take the time to like help you develop your talk. So you have to submit various drafts of your slides and they can review it. And you can also do a dry run where they give you feedback, which I found really helpful as a first time speaker. So I like totally recommend the experience to other people.
Totally. I would be completely nervous speaking in a place like that, especially on my first talk. I have a few conferences coming up, but I don't think I've spoken at something that big a deal, you know? So that's really cool.
The conference is really, really well run, and like the people who run it are like super positive. So I could really only say good things about it. It was a really, really great experience.
So tell us a little bit about progressive web apps for somebody that has no idea what they are. Why do we want to go down that path?
So progressive web apps, like I think what people don't realize is that a lot of the time they're already starting to make a progressive web app. If you are making a website that works on desktop as well as mobile and is responsive, you're well on your way to making a progressive web app. You know, if you've made the transition from HTTP to HTTPS, that means that you can use service workers and you're also on your way to making a progressive web app. So it's more about thinking about just trying to make a website or a web application that is, a better user experience on a mobile device, right? Like, I think we take it for granted. Like, most of us, we're on fairly fast laptops, but when you're on a phone, that processor is much less powerful than a laptop, and you're on a connection that could be spotty. You know, if there's a power outage, or if you're in an airport, or if you're going underground into a tunnel, like, all these things, like, affect your network connections. So it's important to kind of, when you're building a web application, to almost treat it as if someone's going to be using it on a phone, on a 2G or 3G or spotty connection, and just kind of assume they're not going to have the latest and greatest, right? And try to provide a good experience for people coming from all different devices.
That's really cool. I've heard the same thing before. Sometimes you'll have like, so like I consider my phone, this is such a first world problem. I have an iPhone 6. And I feel like such a hipster, right? Like we're talking the original, not even success. And I'm like, man, it's got to be at least, 4 or 5 years old at this point. You know, I think it's barely 3 or something. But that's not old, you know. Like I like to go back and test it, you know, here and there. But there's people out there, you know, that have phones that are much older than the iPhone 6 or even the iPhone 5, for example, right? Or that have half the power, you know, and that there's that whole audience we sort of forget about.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, even when people have really great phones, there's still times where your network connection, like you might be seeing 4 bars on your phone, but you look at the website and that's clearly not the experience you're having, right? So
yeah, the network's a big thing. I was actually out at dinner earlier and I was in a very nice area of town with plenty of connectivity, and I actually had LTE service, 3 bars, and I couldn't pull up a simple website, anything. Like it didn't matter what it was. And so, any of those sites that I had visited before, it would have been awesome to have some form of cache from like a service worker or any kind of layering, you know, some sort of caching on that. Yeah. So it's a very relevant problem, whether you're in the middle of nowhere or underground in a tunnel or, you know, even in a populated area. Yeah. You may not have the connectivity you expect. What are some projects that interest you with the fact of a progressive web app, and what are some of the techniques that you started to explore?
So I think like a few of the websites I've seen that have like really impressed me are like Flipkart and housing.com. In 2015, like Flipkart actually tried to like completely drop their website and have a native only application. And it turned out so badly, they just went back to making a website. And that's when they came out with Flipkart Lite. And they started working really closely, I think, with like the Chrome team to like try to build the best possible experience for people. Flipkart's, I believe, in India. And so like most of their user base is on 2G and 3G connections. So for them, it was really critical to like provide a great experience on like a much slower connection than what we have in North America. And I think that forced them to come up with like, you know, new techniques and technologies that they can share with us. And like, if you check their blog, they tell you about tons of things they tried and like techniques. They did all sorts, like help write libraries with Google. So like you could see there's a bunch of service worker libraries that begin with the SW prefix that they used and contributed to. Yeah. And we could talk about like some of the techniques they did too.
Yeah, I did want to add, one of the gentlemen from Flipkart did a talk, not at this past React Conf, but the one of 2016 React Conf. And I remember the thing that stuck with me the most is that he mentioned that the people in India had such low devices that they needed the memory that an app would take up. So that was their motivation of not using an app, because they already had a web browser. And if they had to download, you know, a 10, 20 meg app and put on their, you know, 64 meg device or something ridiculously small, that they were less inclined to do that. So that was also a factor of going into their, you know, moving back toward, you know, just a website away from the app, because most of their customers didn't have the storage capacity, which is, again, like what Peter was saying, it's something that we do not have, or I do not have an issue. I have 128 gig iPhone 6, and it's absurd. It's amazing. You know, like I have tons of stuff on it, and I'm still not, you know, 3/4 full. But, you know, in those situations, it's you can see why that would be extremely useful. So I just wanted to add that talk's there, and we'll put a link in the show notes to that talk. So
I think another thing that, you know, so people always like equate like native apps with being faster, right? But native apps are still at the mercy of whatever API they happen to be consuming, right?
Absolutely.
So if you're trying to build a native app and, you know, you're just given this API that isn't, you know, built with, you know, your UI or UX in mind, you could be making hundreds and hundreds of API calls, and that could be really slowing down your app. You know, I think, have you heard of that concept, backend for front end?
Yes. Where,
yes, like you're building out a different API layer for your web app versus your native app versus your Android app or your iOS app. So you're serving up different APIs to be fast on all those different devices, right? Whereas if you just build a progressive web app, you can just build one API, and like you can, you know, you don't need three teams. Like you don't need an Android team and an iOS team and a, you know, a web team. You could just have a web team and an API team. So there's also that consideration.
Yeah, absolutely. On that topic, one of the things that when you're talking about APIs that in the past year and a half, I've warmed up to using GraphQL in replacement of those APIs, because it does solve that need of rewriting the same API and then overfetching a ton of data from a mobile app. So I think, and even progressive web apps can benefit from, you know, something like GraphQL. I think it's just the power of those two things together to me seems like a really, really big win for the community. So
absolutely. Like I was reading something like the average web app makes 241 API calls or something on like first load. I don't know if that's true or not, but
wow.
I would bet it does. Yeah, I would bet it does. I've worked on some apps that they were more corporate apps, but there was no attention to like the detail of minimizing API calls. They just kind of downloaded a ton of data and then let the page take care of it. And fortunately, we were able to fix that. But I've seen some sites too that could benefit from not having all those calls.
Yeah, I think the worst I worked on was like, I think I worked on a corporate app where the homepage had 400 API calls. Yeah, there was a lot of discussions involved on bringing that down, but I remember it being pretty difficult. Like people were really adamant that they needed to have all this data on their homepage, which is actually the opposite of what you want to be doing in a progressive web app. Like I think Flipkart on their front page, like their search box, I don't even know if that uses JavaScript. I think they do it server side so they could serve up the, you know, something to users right away, right? So like that's another thing about progressive web apps. It's like you're trying to serve up critical resources as fast as you can. So like if you have like a really big CSS style sheet or a lot of JavaScript, you don't need to upload all that stuff up front, right? You could just upload the things you need absolutely for your homepage and then try to load those other resources later as needed, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess one question I do have though, like regarding exactly what you were just saying. So what if you have an app and you have customers in, you know, all over the United States, and you also have customers in some of these other countries where they may or may not have the type of networks that we have here, or even, you know, you really want to make sure everybody, even here in the U.S., I guess, also maybe doesn't have that high speed. Do you kind of create an app that bundles and serves up different content based on their connection, or do you just try to optimize everything so it works as fast as possible, no matter who is looking at it?
So I think that's where, like, you know, building a really great good progressive web app requires like a lot of teamwork between like your design team and like your stakeholders and your developers. One thing Flipkart had a lot of success with was like a UX pattern called the app shell, where you load the shell of your application up first. It shows, you know, maybe your logo and like the container. And then as they have more of a connection, you can load in like the content inside, and then through API calls, you load in the content, and then you can use stuff such as service workers to cache that content. So if the user happens to go offline, they could still see like the last set of products they're reviewing.
So I guess that brings me to my next question, and you kind of hit on this a little bit, talking about the benefits of using a web app versus a native app. But can you kind of like maybe we can just kick this, you can kick this discussion off. What are the benefits, I guess also the minuses, like what are the pluses and minuses of going with a web app, you know, in 2017 versus going with a native app? I know we hit on some of the things like they don't have to actually go to the app store and download it. But like overall, what are the benefits, I guess, of building a web app and using some of these newer ideas and technologies and concepts versus building a native or maybe a hybrid or React Native type of app?
I think like, you know, one thing that's like really hard to convince like potential, like, you know, stakeholders or clients, and they can't really see it until like you've done all this optimization work is actually happening, is that, you know, the conversion, you know, rate is incredible, right? Like once you have the add to home screen button and you're providing this really like super fast, super zippy experience for people, even when they have flaky network connections, the amount of people who are first time visitors who become long time users of your site, like the increase is like dramatic, right? And it's hard to show people that like until, you know, you do it and then they're able to measure like the before and after of that. But like most of the stories I've seen about progressive web apps, it's like they've been able to attract so many more customers. You know, the bounce rate is way lower. People aren't just leaving after like a minute or two, like waiting for your site to load. And another advantage that people don't think about is just searchability, right? So if like you're a site that's selling a lot of products, people can find those products on a search engine, right? If you have an app, they have to download your app and then use the search engine on your app. Whereas being able to discover products on your website through search engines and other people's sites, it's much easier with a progressive web app.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I guess we've had similar discussions in the past when I'm working as a consultant, you know, talking to companies, and we're at that point where we're at the beginning stage, and we're trying to kind of map out what we're going to be doing. Do they want to build an iOS and an Android app and a web app, or should we just go the web route? And then, you know, you start looking at pricing and all that stuff. It just starts, you know, it kind of confuses them to some extent if they're not already like technical and already know how all this stuff works. But I guess since you work with a lot of startups, kind of what is the price difference as far as building something like this using a team that's competent in a lot of these newer technologies and kind of nailing something that works really good, on a mobile device, and kind of trying to give that close to native experience as possible. Like, what is the price difference between kind of doing that versus building out your mobile website using maybe some outdated maybe technologies, and then also versus building maybe like a native app? Have you seen is there a large difference there usually?
Like, I can't really speak to that because, progressive web app technologies, again, it's like something that's new and like we're just starting to get into too. I know that native app development can be very costly and it's really hard to change layouts compared to like a web application. But I also know that I feel like clients kind of think that increasing the performance or like reducing the load time of your website, like sometimes they think it's just a ticket in Jira and like it's something you can fix in a day. And it takes a lot of like communication to explain that that's not really the fact. Like, I think after I was like following what Flipkart did and I saw their talks, I realized like they had an entire team working on just improving their site performance for like an entire year to get the result they got. Right. So you kind of have to manage those expectations. Like if people want to attract more users, like it is going to take a lot of time. It's technically a little bit tricky, but most importantly, like there's a lot of measuring you have to do. You have to use tools like Lighthouse. And like if you're using React, there's like performance tools to measure your performance. You have to like kind of look at what's making your site take a really long time to load. Sometimes it could be simple. Like sometimes the thing that's like blocking your website from loading is like a third-party analytics script that you maybe don't need, right? But depending on the complexity of your app, it could be really hard to keep that load time down.
So you mentioned Lighthouse. What is Lighthouse? And can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
So Lighthouse is pretty interesting. It's a dev tool developed by the Chrome dev team. And you can install it just like you install any other Chrome add-on, and you can run it against your site, and it'll give you a checklist to let you know, what you've done so far to make your app a progressive web app and things you can work on. So it's really great, and I think it's also really telling that Google has put out a tool like this, because it shows you that page load time is maybe related to your SEO. Like, and that's been my experience. Like whenever I've worked on a website where the page load times were extremely slow, we've had a lot of difficulty with SEO. So I think it does affect like your search engine, like, you know, your performance. So it's definitely a thing to look into, even if you're not trying to make the most progressive web app. It's good to let you know like what you're doing that makes Google put you at the top of the search rankings for your website.
So when it comes to Lighthouse, is that like a tool? So where in the process does Lighthouse come in? Have you built your app and you're ready to sort of figure out where things are going? Would you use Lighthouse from the start, right, as a tool to make sure that things are headed on the right direction? Where do you see it in your workflow?
I think it's tricky, right? Because like there is that like push to put out a lot of features, like especially like you're in the prototype stage and like you're just trying to get investors and stuff, it's probably not the time to be like pulling out Lighthouse. But at the same time, like you maybe like have plateaued with like your users or something, and like you need to speed up your app, or if you know that your audience is going to be like on not the greatest phones right off the bat, maybe that's something you want to start using like right away. But the great thing about Lighthouse is that it's free and like it's really easy to install. So if you want to just take a quick look at your app in like the early stage to see where you're going and what you need to work on, that's another way to look at it too.
Are there any other tools like Lighthouse that you use to kind of help you figure out what you should focus on?
Yeah. Like I found that a couple others, like a coworker introduced me to React Perf Tools, which is another Chrome add-on. You have to install a Node module along with it and then put some code into your React app. But once you read it with this Chrome add-on, it'll tell you which React components are slowing down your app, which I found really neat. And then another thing on my to-do list is like learning to read flame graphs a little bit better.
I'm horrible at reading flame graphs. I'll admit it. You know, I try all the time and I pretend like I know what I'm doing, but you know, I'm still waiting for that tutorial from like Sam Saccone or like Andy Osmani, like really diving into how they work.
Yeah, I was looking at a tutorial he did like a few years ago, but it's definitely like he has that Totally Tooling series on YouTube, and like I want something like at that level. So now that's what I'm used to seeing from him. So
totally. So in terms of like the dev tools, when it comes to progressive web apps, what do you really focus on, you know, when you are trying to make these optimizations?
I think like the stage I'm at right now, it's like, I think like libraries are like the biggest thing for me. Like my libraries always end up being so much bigger than I want them to be. I think like, a big culprit is like, or like big problem libraries for me are like Lodash and Moment.js. Moment's huge. Like when you include Moment into a Webpack project, it tries to include every single locale you can imagine. And I think there's a Webpack plugin called the Ignore plugin that I feel was made just for Moment.js. It lets you ignore all the locales you're not using to reduce the file size of Moment.
That's super interesting. I always see a lot of people talking about how large Moment is, and I use it in a few of my projects, but I've never actually dug into it to see how bad it's hurting us. So I might need to check out that.
Oh, it's huge. The first thing I do like when I'm starting a new project and I'm throwing in Moment is, maybe there is like a cool like Webpack plugin that helps you now, but I've always done like the context replacement plugin where the only, like you kind of use like some regex and go through the locales and only include English. So that's always worked for me, but I'd love to know if there's other ways of making it happen too.
Yeah, it sounds like the context replacement plugin and the Ignore plugin are pretty similar. Like the Ignore plugin, you have to pass in a regex to get it to ignore the locales also. And like, yeah, for Lodash, it's like you have to be really careful not to include the entire library and like only include the modules you need. Yeah. And then I've been in other projects, like I think like we're using HiCharts now, and that's a really big library too. So that's another thing. Like I think there's like cool plugins now. Like you can like create a stats JSON file of your Webpack and you could run it through a Webpack bundle analyzer. And if you want to get really fancy, there's like a dashboard plugin. So every time you do a build in your terminal, you'll see an output of like what your biggest libraries are. It's pretty scary once you see how big these libraries are. And it's confusing too, because like the original minified version might be like 50 kilobytes or something, but somehow it's become like 400 kilobytes in your Webpack build.
That happens all the time to me. And even like, you know, you try to use some of the tools like Babili, for example, which they say not to use, you know, so I guess I shouldn't, but I still do because, you know, and then like the confusion between, you know, ES6 aware minification and like ES5 aware minification, like Uglify, right? Like, and now we have like a new tool, you know, that's really making an impact called Rollup, you know, and I'm just like, where do I, you know, how do I make this a progressive web app?
Yeah, I think like one thing that gives me a bit of hope is that it seems like the Chrome team is really interested in helping people make progressive web apps. And because of this, they've started to take a real interest in Webpack. So they realize how Webpack and things are just so painful for all developers. Sometimes I feel like I'm tweaking my Webpack config over and over, and like I still can't get that file size down, which is pretty frustrating. But it seems like they're trying to come up with new tools. And you know how Rollup had like tree shaking or dead code elimination? That's getting moved to Webpack 2. It's supposed to work out of the box, but I think it only works with Babel. We switched to Webpack 2 a few weeks ago, but we're still trying to tweak our config file to get tree shaking working for us.
Speaking of Webpack and you know, the progressive web apps, one technique is to try to break up your bundles so that they load asynchronously instead of what I typically have Webpack doing right now, which is load everything into one massive bundle and then ship that to the user. Have you worked with anything related to that to break your pages up so that let's just say your bundle includes like a login page and that's the first thing that would come, but the user wouldn't download a product list React page template or about page or something like that. Have you done anything with that?
Yeah, we've done a bit of it at our office with kind of mixed results. I think because code splitting works slightly differently in like Webpack 1 versus Webpack 2. So in Webpack 1, you could use like require.ensure. And then in Webpack 2, I think there's import. And it also depends, like it's good to split your code by routes, but depending on which version of React router you're using, there's like different ways to split your code by route. So I'm sure like you've probably worked with React Router. You've heard mm-hmm. what I've heard, which is React Router 4 is a breaking change. And their way to split Webpack code by route is like different from what the Webpack docs recommend.
Mm-hmm.
So Webpack has gone from system import to just import. And then I believe React Router 4 is recommending using a slightly different method to split their bundles. So I think if you're like on a longstanding project, I could see like if you and your team make a decision, like we're going to stick with this version of Webpack and we're going to stick with a particular version of React Router, it'd be good to implement code splitting at that time. It seems like it's kind of shifting a bit still. I guess that's my observation.
Right. Also on that topic, you know, the benefits of code splitting could be more, could actually incentivize your website, possibly with the tool like Lighthouse, because our servers are going to HTTP2 and you're actually able to download a site faster the more files it has. And I'm not sure if any of y'all have seen that, but there's a demo if you just Google HTTP2 demo and you'll be able to click on like this button and it'll download it over HTTP1 and then it'll download it over HTTP2. And it's downloading, you know, hundreds of little small bits, small files. And that's, it actually performs faster on HTTP2. And so I'm just wondering, like, you know, are we at the point where we've existed for all these years and we've gotten into these bundles, whereas we used to have things broken up, and now the pattern is really to start splitting things out again, and not necessarily you won't download it synchronously. So I wouldn't necessarily download the login page first. That could be like an optimization, but maybe a service worker or something in the background would be downloading your other templates over HTTP2. Does that make sense? Like the other pieces that were split out?
Yeah. So I think like historically when you use script tags to load in your JavaScript, that was actually like blocking. So like Chrome is really big on this whole concept of like blocking. And like, if you have something that's blocking your page load, that means like let's say you had 10 script tags full of JavaScript, and you put that in your head of your HTML document, like all of those scripts would have to like load and like be executed before the HTML, before you even see your page. But now there's ways to load scripts in parallel in a non-blocking way. And I think the most recent way is to use the link tag with the preload attribute, rel preload. So that's their new way that's recommended. It loads your script in the background, and it's non-blocking, which means users can see and interact with your web page while that script is loading in the background. And right now it only works on Chrome, but like I noticed that the Filament group has written a polyfill for it. So it is something you could probably use in older browsers. And then you could use something like a service worker to cache like assets so people don't have to download again on the next load, such as fonts and logos, that kind of thing.
So what you're saying, I guess you and Kevin were kind of just discussing there. So the newer like version of HTTP, HTTP2, it's going to actually be faster with more files, I guess, and smaller size files?
Yeah, it's actually the more files you have, the faster it's going to be, just because of what Nicole was just talking about with the ability to asynchronously download it. Now, of course, that's over the protocol, but then there is that technique she just mentioned about being able to, you know, asynchronously download and not really block the user from doing things. So
so that's like moving completely away from what's been happening, right? In the community, right, and the ecosystem lately. That's so interesting. I think it's a big deal or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm certainly wondering, you know, how do I go forward where I've got all this time and I'm happy with a single bundle. But you know, do I need to be more aggressive? So things I'm thinking about like to solve this are, you know, do I need to be more aggressive with chunking and make a very small, like, you know, only deliver 1 kilobyte chunks of our site, right? So that it's split up into multiple bundles so that I'm not penalized over if someone comes to my site in Chrome and they have HTTP2 available, you know, Chrome is going to download those multiple files, say that it breaks everything up. Say I've got 100 kilobytes worth of JavaScript and I break them into 1 kilobyte chunks, assuming I can do that with Webpack. I haven't actually looked into that, but as far as that small, but you know, essentially they would have 100 downloads that would load faster than if I had the single bundle that was 100 kilobytes over HTTP1. So it's kind of crazy to think about that, but that's exactly what's available. So
yeah, like I think also like you know, you could split your code out, like even if you can't fully get it up and running, splitting it by route, like you could still use the common chunks plugin to split out. It'll try to find, you know, common modules that you're using over and over again, and then you could tell it to split it into how many chunks. And I know there's this new thing now called Webpack performance budgets, where I'll try to recommend the minimum and maximum size for each chunk for you. So that way, if you start adding new libraries, it'll like warn you if your chunks are getting like too big or anything like that.
So I guess we would kind of consider all of the stuff we're talking about. This is more like an advanced stuff. So if like you're kind of a beginner developer, would you recommend kind of like trying to worry about all this stuff? Or is this kind of... It seems more like, you know, intermediate to advanced stuff, right?
Yeah, I think like one thing that's cool about using Lighthouse is like there's still things you can do to, you know, get on your way to being like more progressive. Like, you know, if your site is just HTTP, like moving it to HTTPS is like a huge deal, right? And then that could set you up. Like you can't really use service workers until your site is HTTPS. So that's one thing to think about. And I think another thing for like, I think beginners to think about is just like try to keep your images small. We're loading like really, really big images in. Sometimes like the size of one image on your website ends up being bigger than your entire bundle JS file. And if that's not critical, meaning like that image isn't shown above the fold, like there really isn't a need to load in an image that big, I think. Another thing like I've been thinking about a lot lately are like web fonts. Cause I didn't realize this, but like sometimes when you load in a web font, it can have like thousands of glyphs. you know, and if you're only writing, say, English and French, like, because I'm from Toronto, like, you don't need all of those characters, right? So in your CSS, there's actually ways to limit the amount of Unicode characters that you're like importing into your web application.
No way.
Yeah. It's like something you don't even think about. Like, you just load in the entire font. But like, some fonts are like, they have characters in languages that you probably don't even need. Like, it's in Japanese or, you know, like other languages that like you really don't need for your website. So, I think Jake Archibald like wrote some pretty cool articles about that. And another developer, Monica Dinkusulu, I could be pronouncing her name incorrectly, she wrote a really good article about how to like asynchronously load your web font. So there's a problem, like if you don't load your web font in like a non-blocking way, there's this phenomenon called flash of invisible text, where you just see underlines or like empty spaces where your text is supposed to show up until your web font loads. So you could set your CSS to display that font optionally. That way users can see text until your web font loads, or you could try to load the web font asynchronously and then provide a fallback font that's default in the web browser. So yeah, just something to think about, like people on phones, right? Like if they have a flaky connection, they want to see content right away. It might not be the most important thing for them to see like your custom web font right away.
So I'm kind of curious, this is kind of a broad question, and I'm wondering what everyone's opinion is progressive, building a progressive web app, is that just part of being a web developer these days? Like, is this going to be like the default way to do things, like all of these techniques we're talking about, is this going to be kind of expected as far as going forward in a couple of years? Or is this more like specific use cases? You know, like, does the average web developer need to worry about all this stuff?
I think that they do. I feel like I'm in the same situation over and over, where a client insists that they only want their website to work on a desktop. And then one night they happen to be showing it to their friends on a phone and they wonder why it's taking so long to load, or why they aren't able to like press a button and make something happen on their phone. So it's something you have to keep in the back of your mind and be ready to like educate your clients on and like sort of manage those expectations, right?
Yeah, I think so too.
I think it's the new normal. It's okay though, because you don't really have to take advantage or you don't have to do everything there. And one thing I want to point out, just reiterate again, that Nicole mentioned earlier, that Nicole, you mentioned that a company you were aware of had an entire team that was working a year on certain optimizations. And so, you know, those of us that are on very small teams, or on a single project as a developer, I would say use the best practices and be aware of what you're doing. Like the things that Nicole mentioned with the fonts, you know, you may be using an entire font, a web font, but you're only using two icons. You know, one way to optimize could be to you know, make that into you know, only load those specific icons elsewhere. Maybe a font might not be the best way. So I would also have some advice, just not to focus on optimization too early in the process. It's okay to be aware of where you want to go, but build the thing and ship it, and actually start using it on different devices, different networks. And then there's also a Chrome plugin, and there is also it's actually in the Chrome DevTools. You can simulate different network conditions. So if you go under the preferences, you can choose a variable it's just called network conditions under the more tools section in the Chrome DevTools, and it can throttle or it can help you simulate like an offline or 2G connection or Wi-Fi. So that there's that technique as well to hit your site at and see how it performs under different things. And then there's even a desktop app. I forget the name at this point. But it will randomly, you start it running in like your toolbar, and it will randomly throttle all of your web traffic. So, you can kind of see how other sites perform under, you know, random network conditions. So.
Absolutely. And like, I think another thing too, for like, you know, if you're working on a sort of like more of a marketing site and stuff, is that like, it's important to be aware of like the implications of third-party JavaScript. Like even stuff like a lot of like or share buttons, like if you look at your network tab, you might discover, you know, like loading like that analytics script or that like tracking script is like, you know, it's like the one thing that's actually slowing down your website.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've seen that happening so many times. I've seen like a lot of these news sites now and a lot of these sites that make their money off of advertising. If you actually open up the console and kind of see what's going on there, it's just a ridiculous amount of like requests going on. And it's almost insane sometimes that these companies are like million-dollar companies and they're doing this. I feel like if you can kind of take advantage of some of these technologies and implement them in your app, you can basically set yourself apart if you provide an equal, you know, experience and you're in like a similar space. Just not doing, you know, not giving a terrible user experience can kind of be something to set you apart if you're looking for that something.
Sure.
Yeah, to piggyback off the marketing thing you just mentioned, I've done a lot of work with web apps that were not the marketing website. So the performance for a web app that someone's going to use to file expenses or to do some sort of process, it's not that it doesn't necessarily need to be fast and responsive, but the goals are different for a marketing website versus a web app. So getting your page load time to under a second for someone that is required by their company to file their expenses through your web application is not probably where your company is going to, where you should spend your time focus. You should certainly make the thing perform as fast as it can, but the needs are just completely different from someone that where revenue is tied either through a marketing site or through an e-commerce site. So be mindful of whatever, what you're building and frame your optimizations accordingly.
Okay, let's go ahead and jump to the picks. Kevin, do you have any picks today?
Yeah, I do. I have one pick. I've been doing some work in React Native, and I've had the need to access a existing web application, log the user in and store that login in state, so save a cookie. And there's a package called React Native Cookies, and it's plural. It's on GitHub, and I'll put the link in the show notes. And what it does is it's a cookie manager for React Native that uses the same shared memory for a web view. So in my React Native application, I allow the user to log in, and then I display them a native list view that has been authenticated, that carries that cookie up to the server, gets the authenticated list, and then I give them a React Native list view of their titles. But once they click on one of those, I want to launch them into a web view that fires up the website, the mobile website that actually renders that title. And so this cookie manager allows me to do that. So that kind of in the theme of this progressive web app, I can progressively migrate from a web app, mobile website to a React Native application without having to fully implement all the bells and whistles in the first go. So React Native Cookies is first pick. My second pick is a post by Spencer Carley, and he's actually here in Nashville, Tennessee. And he's got a post on how to use the flatlist component in React Native, which the flatlist component and the sectionlist component are new components in React Native 0.43. So I encourage you to check that out. And he's also got a it's a post on Medium, but it's also a YouTube video that'll walk you through building a flat list. And what that does is really combine, it takes the cumbersomeness of managing data away from a list view. So it's a nice abstraction on a list view. It makes it much easier to work with. And my last pick is a book by Seth Godin. It's been out for a while, but I'm just now listening to it. It's called The Icarus Deception. It's a really neat book just for motivation. And I'm intrigued by it. It just helps me kind of focus on kind of working through the drudgery of a project or something that I'm working through. So that's it.
Nicole, do you have any picks?
I guess I have two picks. Just because it's coming up, I would like to mention the Hot Docs Festival. It's a documentary film festival in Toronto. It's starting this month. They show really great documentaries. And if you can't come to Toronto to watch it, I believe you can watch the best of the best of Hot Docs on iTunes. And the other thing I'd like to mention is Totally Tooling. It's a video series on YouTube. And one thing I really like about it, it's a very short, approachable series of videos on how to improve your tooling, your skills with Webpack, Travis, that kind of thing. I think it's a really great series, and it makes these really complicated tooling topics a lot more approachable for regular web developers.
Awesome. I haven't heard of that. Can you repeat the name one more time?
It's called Totally Tooling. And it's run by Addis Osmani. Terrible pronunciation. But yeah, it's called Totally Tooling, and it's a web series. I think one thing I really like is that each video is really short. It's 6 to 8 minutes. And they go through things like code splitting or using Travis or how to write tests with Mocha using Gulp. So really great if you need to get up to speed really quickly, and they're really entertaining also.
Very nice. I just subscribed. Thank you for that one. Peter, do you have any picks?
Yeah, so if you haven't heard about Liarbird, it's the coolest and creepiest thing ever. You can copy the voice of anyone. So you pass in a 1 minute recording. It could be, a family member. It could be, Trump, the president. It could be whomever you'd want it to be. And you can literally start synthesizing and using their voice. And their website actually has a demo with different presidents talking to each other. And obviously you might, it's not perfectly natural, but it's so impressive. You're just there's no way. How do they do this?
And what's it called again?
Liarbird.ai is the website. Lyre. I don't know how to pronounce that. Bird.ai.
I'm writing that one down.
Yeah. So my picks, my first pick is a book that I started reading called The Million Dollar Consultant. It was recommended to me by one of my friends, and it's really awesome. If you kind of ever want to at least consider getting into consulting, or you want to do it full time, this guy, he's written so many books about consulting. He seems to be the go-to person. I'm going to have to look up his name real quick. But basically, if you kind of are interested in it, this is a really good book. It gives some really practical advice, and a lot of stuff about it, I guess, just made a whole lot of sense to me. And it kind of just clicks. His name is Alan Weiss. He's kind of one of the top people as far as consulting goes, as far as having books and stuff like that out. So, yeah, totally check that out. Another one of my picks is it's going to be React Native Training. That's the company that I started a few months ago. We're doing a lot of trainings now. We've picked up a few new clients recently. We launched a YouTube channel recently. So I think I mentioned that on one of the past episodes, but we're putting up a few episodes every week. So if you're interested in very niche kind of advanced to intermediate stuff with React Native, totally check it out, and leave us comments if you have any ideas for any topics that you kind of want to see on there in the future. Okay, well, that wraps up episode 63 of React Native Radio. Nicole, thank you so much for coming on. I think this is a really, really interesting conversation, and I'm sure a lot of people will get a lot of benefit out of it.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It's been great.
Okay, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.